If that's true, I will say a lot of people have come down hard on me in life, and so I it's never been something I've held on to because of the fact that it's part of life. It's just part of life. But thank you, John. That's very graceful of you. And so now it's time to forget whatever it was, because I have. So let it go. And I'm really glad you're part of this. I want to just to I'm going to give a summary of kind of what we've been talking about, but I'm really glad that Chris Drukas and Tom Kinnear didn't get a chance to say hi to Tom and Sean, but hi, Tom. Hi, Sean. Tom Kinnear and Sean Monger are coming on to this. They are three of our therapists who work out of the Westminster offices, and both. So all three are really tremendous therapists, which is why we hired them at Samaritan, because that has always been a big part of Samaritan. You know, Chris has been part of Samaritan 18 years, Chris?
20.
20. Tom has been, I think, 2.5 years.
Two and a
Tom,
half.
is that right?
Yep.
And then Sean just started in December.
Yeah.
And I'm going to let them introduce themselves to you real quick, and then I'll give a summary of what we've talked about, and then kind of talk about what we're going to do. But Chris, a lot of them know you, so I'm going to go ahead and have you start, and then we'll move on to Tom and then Sean.
Hi, everyone. Yeah, you know me, Chris Drukas. I'm licensed as a marriage and family therapist, but have been a longtime member of Westminster and served as an elder under when Jim was here, and I was lucky to do that. So, I work relationally with people. So whether I'm seeing individuals or couples, really relational concerns. So the topic of forgiveness is so important. So I'd love to hear this talked about and happy to share with you what that looks like in the clinical room. So glad to be here.
Thanks. Tom.
Yes. As Graham said, I've been with Samaritan 2.5 years. Prior to that, I had two or three different careers, mostly administrative type jobs. I have seven adult children and 15 grandchildren, so I'm very familiar with forgiveness, mostly asking for it. The clients that I see just are on a broad range, and been able to apply this topic as well. So look forward to being able to share that.
Thanks, Tom. Sean.
Hi. I'm Sean. I've been here since December. Before I was counseling at Samaritan, I was doing family-based therapy. So I was going into people's homes and really working on mending some of those family relationships. And before that, I was in a day treatment program. I'm working with troubled youth. So again, there's a lot of pain, even when it doesn't always take the name of a forgiveness problem. It's there.
Good. Well, thanks, Sean. Well, let me. Here's what I'm going to do, most of this is really going to be them, not me. I'm going to give you kind of a summary. I did give a summary to the three of them. I think Chris has actually watched the classes, or at least some of them, or at least parts of some of them, or at least was nice enough to say she did.
All of
Either
them.
one, all of the, okay. So you kind of have an understanding of kind of what we've been talking about. The past 3 weeks, we've talked about, number one, the first week was really a focus on what does it mean to forgive? And we took the root of the word forgive for the definition that it's for, or the old German fair, which means ultimate or utmost, and give, which is a gift. And it's the idea that when we forgive, we are giving the utmost, the ultimate present. It's an ultimate gift we can give another. And like all gifts, you know, there's a tendency sometimes for people to think that you have to earn forgiveness. And I think that there's time when repentance, and I haven't actually talked about this, but where repentance and asking for forgiveness is important. But ultimately, the forgiveness is a gift that we give to someone, whether they've earned it or it's not been earned. It's something we give to them, and it's something we give to ourselves. And we talked about how forgiving isn't condoning. When you forgive, it doesn't mean you say, and what you did is okay. It also is not forgetting. That, you know, the pain will always linger there. but you're disconnecting from the memory. You're disconnecting in a sense where you're not allowing that memory to hold on to you. It's not capitulating. Actually, I don't think I said it this way, but to me, it's like Jesus saying, turn the other cheek. You know, when you turn the other cheek, and this is something that Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. taught, many others have, you actually stand back up into someone's face and say, you've hurt me, and but I will not back down. But I also will not strike you. And I will be forgiving, but it's not capitulation. Forgiving is strength, not weakness. It takes an awful lot of strength to forgive. It's not weakness, and is rooted in generosity as much as it is in love. And forgiving is also healing, that when we forgive, we begin to heal relationships, we begin to heal ourselves. That in the second class, I talked about what makes forgiving so hard. And I talked about the biological roots of forgiving, that I basically said, you know, the inability to forgive is really rooted in our survival instinct. That you all know this, that when you've been hurt, there's something about you that just won't allow you to forgive. And it's because you have a self-protective survival instinct within you, and you have to transcend it, and you have to overcome it, and you have to try to move beyond it. But it's very hard when we're rooted in kind of a survival mindset. And it gets even harder when we're kind of rooted in a tribal mindset. You know, I've got to protect myself and our family and our people and things like that. And then last week we talked about how to forgive, and that I talked about Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs and about this idea of transcendence, that when we struggle to forgive, it's because we're living in kind of a physiological security mindset. And forgiving really means transcending that to being open to what God is asking us to do and asking God to do it through us. And then we also talked about what's called cognitive behavioral therapy, concepts of triggers, thoughts, actions, consequences, habits. And we talked about how when we forgive, it's trying to craft a new thought and a new way of acting to the triggers. I have been very purposeful in teaching the class of integrating insights from a lot of different fields. And the reason why I say that is, I think one of the difficulties too often when we come at it from a Christian perspective is that we just stay in scripture. One of the things I was taught when I was doing my doctorate for spiritual formation is they often said that spirituality is the integrating dimension of life, that it integrates all others. And it's too often we silo, we only get our thinking in one area and that becomes the dominant. And I think my approach tends to integrate theology and spirituality and liturgy and psychology and sociology and social work and politics and economics and anthropology and art and literature, and it's bringing insights from all of them. And that's what I've actually tried to do here. And this is one of the reasons why I invited Chris and Tom and Sean to be part of it, because I talked about conceptually what it means to forgive. These three are kind of in the forgiving guidance industry. Maybe that's the best way to say it is, you know, Chris works with families, and quite frankly, you can't repair marital and family relationships unless people are willing to forgive. Sean has worked the same with families, and it's a very similar concept. Is when you're doing wraparound, you're working with families that have been really, you know, torn apart, sometimes abusive, sometimes others. And there's a level to which you have to encourage people to do that. And Tom also has been working in that, not only as a therapist, but I mean, Tom has worked in administration and deans in colleges and universities, and has worked with people in all different wakes of life. And so it's part of that. So that's kind of the background. And what I'm going to do is I sent them questions ahead of time, but what I basically said was, I've got questions prepared. Here are the questions, but I'm going to really follow wherever they go and kind of interject in that way. So I'm going to basically ask a first question, and I'll ask it for all three of you, and then we'll kind of see where we go. But in your work with clients, how have you seen the unwillingness to forgive impact your clients' lives? And I'll let whichever one of the three of you wants to go first. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I want to address that, but I wanted to make a bridge. Can I just say a couple words, Graham, to bridge classes we're doing and kind of the clinical work? If I could just take a minute to do that. Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead.
I love to hear that you were talking about the neuroscience and Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And so the way I talk to people about this, because we're wired for protection, like you were describing, but we're also wired for connection. We're designed to be relational. And I think we all know that inherently. And so the way I talk to people about this is that there's seven neural pathways that we have. And three of them are about threat detection. And four of them are about connection, love, joy, peace. So even though the threat detectors are outnumbered, they're kind of the bodyguards, right? They're the muscle, and they're going to shoot first, ask questions later. And so unless you are safe, you're really not going to have the space to connect and have peace, love, and joy in all of this. So I start by kind of explaining that to people because I'm dealing with a lot of people with relational trauma. And so there've been these wounds and they are on threat detection. So they're having a hard time with this connection piece. So I kind of frame it that there's this dual consideration of connection and protection at the same time. And so, you know, we're designed to be relational, but there's a lot of problems with that because of the relational trauma they're coming in with. So it's all about kind of harmony, disharmony, repair. All relationships go through these cycles. And really, no matter if I'm seeing individuals or if I'm seeing couples, we're dealing with these repair issues of how is it you repair. So forgiveness, although never stated as the presenting problem and never even stated as a goal, is essential to all of the work that we're doing, all the work that I'm doing. It's just not named, right? So I think when this first question comes up about the unwillingness, I don't think sometimes people even realize that's true. I would never say that to someone. It's never framed that way in my mind, even that they're unwilling. I don't think they even understand that trauma that they've experienced and the things they're holding on to. It's not until we get going and start unpacking that, because they're presenting with language of, I'm not getting along with my spouse or my sibling or my kids, or I have anxiety or I have depression. So it's never explicitly that I can say to someone or ever really thinking that this is a person unwilling to forgive. You see what I'm saying? So but we unpack that. And so there's so much there and there's so many layers of family of origin and forgiving themselves for things. There's a lot of a negative mindset. So usually we're starting with themselves and backwards and then current. But there's a huge impact of, I just would never frame it as unwillingness. I think there's just
right. Well, and Chris, kind of what you're saying though, is even in couples you work with, there might have been something that happened early on in the dating or the relationship that one person cannot forgive the other for, but they also aren't really fully aware of it, which is, I think, part of what you're saying.
Yes. And that's the work of the therapy, is to really unpack that. Is that, and the way that's thought of in attachment theory is that, you know, healthy attachment is based on the belief that when I need you, you'll be there, whether it's parent, child, friends, couples, whatever. And there are these attachment wounds that occur in which I needed you when you weren't there. It could be 20 years ago.
Yeah.
It could have been last week. So I would never frame it as unwillingness though, because I think they're hanging on to that for a survival instinct that you mentioned, right? Because if I don't keep bringing up how hurtful that was, my fear is that you will do that again.
Yep. Yep.
So
Tom, what are your thoughts about that?
Actually, when you started talking about trauma, I went right to my anger management clients. I'm, as Graham knows, I'm certified anger management specialist. So court ordered anger management is one of the things that comes my way. And the individuals that come usually have a long history of troubled behavior and in and out of legal issues. And so their expectation or their goals are pretty limited. They want to comply with what they've been asked to do. But once we actually get into the process, it's amazing to me how quickly they move to sources of their anger. So, you know, we do explore a little bit about their growing up years. And very often, I find that they were subject to some of the things that Chris was mentioning, neglect or abuse or something of that nature that they didn't necessarily understand as a deficit in their life. They kind of assumed that, you know, most families are like this. They'll say things like, oh yeah, everybody makes mistakes. And so they gloss over this stuff and they don't make a connection between some of those deficits and their anger. And the anger became a defense. You know, it was this is how I stay safe. I act out in anger. And when we get to the issue of, well, do you see or do you have any lingering issues with your parents or the folks that were involved in your raising, they're real quick to move to, well, yeah, I don't talk to them anymore, or we don't have much of a relationship. But then it bounces quickly to, but I know I gave them a hard time, or I know I was really a troubled kid, and it goes right to themselves instead. And so honestly, some of the forgiveness work that I end up doing in the anger management classes is self-forgiveness. Yeah. They haven't given themselves that kind of mercy. And so, it sort of opens a new door to them. And honestly, it's probably a bigger struggle than forgiving someone else. They really have felt blamed. And of course, some of that has come from external sources. People have said it's their fault. But then when they get into the self-blame and the shame that goes with that, that becomes a much bigger focus for us.
Yeah, I part of what I'm hearing you say, Tom, is the anger they develop is like a fortress to keep them safe. Mm-hmm. But part of that anger is also lobbing missiles at others to keep them away. Mm-hmm. And in some ways you have to do two things at once, help them to develop skills where they're not lobbing missiles, but also help them develop skills where they're pulling down the walls of the fortress. And mm-hmm. it's really hard because they've been built up over years and they've been stockpiling ammunition for a long time.
Yeah, and that's a good point. It really is in the seminar that I do, we do a lot of coping skills because they were not taught other coping skills. So they have, it's that old cliche, you know, if you have a hammer, every problem's a nail. So that's all they've got. And the coping skills that we teach end up becoming, it's foreign to them at first, but once they start using them, they realize, oh yeah, there is an alternative.
Yeah. Sean, you've been nodding your head. What are your thoughts?
Thanks, Graham. So when I'm looking at all of this, I'm thinking about shame in particular really resonates in the sense of lack of forgiveness of self. And it's a very powerful element there that can really lead people into behaviors that they don't like. And when you really try to tackle that shame, that self-forgiveness, what you run into is that people don't even know how to handle this. You have so many different feelings. And I like to always tell people, you know, that their feelings are there for a reason. They're there to tell them something, to do something good if they're from a Christian perspective. I say they're a gift from God. So you have your anger that tells you something's wrong and gives you the strength to do something about it. But when out of sorts, it doesn't give you the right thing to do. You know, you have the sadness that says, I'm hurting, I want to connect. But then what do you do with the shame that keeps coming up? Well, shame is this twisted form of guilt. So you have the guilt that would drive you to try to make amends for your wrongs and reconnect with the community, but that shame gets twisted. And instead you see yourself as unforgivable, as somebody who can't be part of the community. Then you only see yourself as your fault. So really part of healing that is helping the clients to have the strength to face that shame, to face that and to look it in the eye and to see it for what it is. So that way they can forgive themselves and move forward in their healing. And sometimes that also involves, a lot of times that involves the forgiveness of others in their lives. Some of them aren't ready to have that conversation with clients. So a lot of times one thing that clients do is write a letter to somebody in their life that they really need to wrestle out that forgiveness with, but don't send it to them. But that way they can really pour out what's on their heart so that they can start to work through the pain, so that they can come to that fuller appreciation of that person is more than the fault, and that healing that they can start to let go.
You know, something all three of you have talked about, which I just occurs to me, helping people to learn to forgive is what I would call gently firm work. And what that means is every time you meet with them, you have to kind of achieve this balance between being gentle with them enough to help them move forward, but firm enough to push them to go forward and face these things. And it's, you know, that seems to me to be part of the struggle of forgiveness is forgiving others or forgiving ourselves. Is it's just really painful to look inward at this stuff. And I think, Sean, something you're saying is, you know, there's almost two kinds of shame that come. There's like an internal shame of I'm ashamed of what I have done. Mm-hmm. And then there's an external shame of you have spent your life being shamed by others for things you may or may not have done. Mm-hmm. And that it's when you're ashamed of things you've done, it's a self-forgiveness question. But yeah. when you are shamed by others, it becomes of how do I forgive them mm-hmm. for shaming me for things that I wasn't even really guilty of, but they told me I was anyway. They told me I was worthless. They told me that, you know, I was no good. They told me that I was bad. And, you know, I began to own that, and that became self-damaging.
Yes. And a lot of times when they are, that shaming from others is coming from another place of where they don't know what they're doing. They're in their own pain. They're blinded by this. And our clients, they start to see that as they process this. They go, no, they were dealing with their own hurts, and then they allowed that to hurt me. And they just get this fuller picture. I believe you said in your very first talk here about how forgiveness is really helping to see that fuller picture. And I remember that story that you were talking about confronting that bomber, the father of the bomber. And then when they saw the graduation picture, and then you saw him as more than just the bomber, but as this person with this full complex life. And I think that's that process of healing too with our clients. Sometimes it's seeing, you know, my mom was horrible to me, and I see where it's coming from. She had it horrible too, and didn't know how to handle me. And I'm trying to work through this, and she should have worked through that. And I wish she would have had the chance to work through that too.
Yeah, you remind me of a phrase I developed a long time ago, which is no matter how old we are, we're all still kids. We just don't look like it. And, you know, there's a level to which, as you get older, you know, most of us, you know, there's still something of that kid inside of us that actually doesn't know what we're doing. We're just, you know, we're faking it, you know, because we're supposed to, you know, and the people who supposedly knew what they were doing, they died or they passed on. Let me move to a second question. And, you know, Chris, it is okay to change the question. You know, that as you said, it's not unwillingness. I just grabbed questions, really. Take them wherever you want. So I'm going to do the second question, which is, what's the biggest obstacle you tend to see in your clients' ability to forgive others and forgive themselves? And you can do both, either, whatever you want. But what's the biggest obstacle you see in your work with them?
I think it's back where I was starting before, is kind of the lack of awareness, the lack of insight of the layers and how much this is all built upon. It's not a matter of just going out and forgiving others. Just as Sean was saying, that work has to be done inside out first, because then they have the capacity to do for themselves and then hear the feedback from others, repair with others. But they can't do that when they go into these shame states. So the barriers, I think, are the long-term conditioning they received in childhood. I mean, children have no boundaries. They cannot distinguish what's true and what's not. They take in whatever people are telling them about themselves. And so there's long history of these conditioned, negative, distorted messages about their relationship to themselves and to others. And so people come in with all of that there. That's all that gunk. So we've got to unpack that and work through that. So there's nothing quick about it.
Yeah. And you're hitting on something that's really important. And I think it's part of not just forgiving work, but it's part of psychological work, maturity, spiritual work. You have to become self-aware. We don't live in a culture that prizes self-awareness. We live in a culture that does prize achievement, that actually worships celebrities who, you know, may be some of the most unself-aware people ever. They just aren't. It's just, they may be aware enough to write an interesting lyric or paint something, but, you know, I'll put it this way. I don't look at the Kardashians as being the pinnacle of self-awareness. They run billion-dollar industries. And I think, you know, part of Chris, what you're saying is, and this is kind of going with Sean, is it's really hard work to help people become self-aware, especially when they are immersed in those three neural pathways you talked about, and they're struggling with the four connectional ones when they're really rooted in the self-protective ones. It's very difficult to make somebody who's self-protective to be self-aware.
There's a way. The way is, and that's the phases of therapy. The phases of therapy are such that my first job is to just take in the person hobbling in. I'm just being compassionate. Yeah. I'm really hearing and understanding their story from their perspective. So once we get all of that out, they feel heard and they feel understood. They're much more malleable. They're listening, and COVID's been a blessing in this, that people aren't canceling. People are coming consistently to the appointments. And so we really, you know, can chip away at this. And it's just slow and steady. I'm hearing, I'm understanding, I'm helping them make sense of their experience. And then I'm starting to make connections between the stories they're telling me about childhood or less than nurturing experiences in any relationship, what their current suffering is, and what the link is between then and now in a way that they haven't considered before. And so it's just slowly kind of piecing this together. And we are starting to shift the perspective of what has happened before and new ways to think about what's happened. Because in the family trauma, the narrative that exists is whoever's most powerful. If mom says this is the way that it is, then that's the way that it is. And as a kid, you're really not, you think it's off, but what do you know? It must be me. And so there's a lot of that shame and that built-in distorted sense of, so to be able to say what they think and feel and have someone say that makes a lot of sense is sometimes very different for them. And I think there's a lot of healing in that.
I'm going to throw something out, which is sort of it's not a segue. It's a little bit of a non sequitur, but it's something that you have, that you're making me think of that I kind of want to address. And I want to go back and ask the question to Tom and Sean. Yeah. You know, I don't know how many of you saw the Meghan Markle interview with, you know, Oprah. I have been around enough people now who have dismissed what they have said, basically saying, well, they can't have mental health issues. I mean, look at how wealthy they are. Look at their lives. And, to me, it's, you know, having grown up in the main line of Philadelphia and in Swickley, what I've realized is actually when you are very wealthy and have, the means to purchase really nice things, what you're able to do is to hide your mental illness even better behind high hedges and manicured lawns and nice furniture. But I've had to have this discussion with several people who just simply say, she wasn't really telling the truth. I mean, you know, how bad can her problems be? I mean, look at how wealthy they are. And, my only response was, well, I will tell you, our offices in Strickley and Upper St. Clair have done really, really, really well. And part of it is that we help people who hide their mental illness issues. Go ahead, Chris. Yeah.
Sorry. The way I talk to people about that, once I have their ear, once they feel understood, of course, is this education piece, which is to talk to them about, it really resonates, you know, with the unhealthy sources of self-esteem, what I have, what I do, what other people think of me. And that really resonates for people. And I do a drawing of relationship grid and how this plays out and how this affects self-esteem. And really the goal of living spiritually, of living relationally, is to be with a healthy regard of self and a healthy regard of others, that I can hold myself in warm regard despite my mistakes and imperfections. I can hold others in warm regard despite their mistakes and imperfections. And then we have grace and back and forth and give and take and all these lovely healthy things. But that's not people's experience. But that does resonate with them. So,
yeah. Oh. And sometimes the drive to be successful is a drive to overcome trauma and shame, absolutely, you know, to prove what I'm doing. So I'm going to move on. Tom,
yeah,
you can jump in with what we just been talking about, or you can kind of go back to the question of what's the biggest obstacle you see in your client's ability to forgive?
Yeah, I think the obstacle that I most often run across is the fact that we don't have a model that we've seen that is anything like God's model for forgiveness. So when you suggest forgiveness, the first thing that seems to come up are things like, well, yeah, when they apologize, or yeah, when they acknowledge right, what they did was wrong,
right?
Or yeah, when they come and so it, there's a justice thing, you know, like, and maybe it's in the American mentality, or maybe it's wider, but it's this is unfair. I was hurt, I was wronged, and that needs to be addressed before I'm going to forgive. And so when I run up against that, we usually talk through a little bit about what their expectation is. When do you think that might happen? What would have to happen for it to satisfy you? And they run up against some dead ends there. And so we end up talking about, so in the meantime, if you're going to wait for that, how is it affecting you? And then they really start acknowledging, yeah, I'm the one that's suffering. I've got the poison. I'm the one that is hurting because of this. My lack of forgiveness, or my insistence that they're going to have to do X, Y, or Z first, isn't hurting them. So once we start moving in that direction, there's at least the understanding that, yeah, if I want to find peace and freedom, they're actually holding the power over me. I've given the power to them because I've said, you need to apologize before I'll be free. And yeah, so when they can shift the power and take it back and say, no, actually, I'm going to take the power back, and I'm going to forgive, or start moving towards forgiveness, because I know that's what's good for me and that I'm going to find freedom there. So that's usually a key point, is you know, getting past that justice and fairness thing.
It's kind of like, I'm going to stay in this prison until you show me that you're willing to open the door. And it's like, yeah, but the door's open. Yeah. And it's like, oh, right. But no, until they come and actually open it, I'm not going to walk out.
Yeah.
Sean, what are your thoughts?
Well, there's a couple different factors, I think, to play in. One is something we call like a circle of anxiety, or a cycle of anxiety. The more you avoid something, the harder it is to face. And things like forgiveness and shame, people make a big point of avoiding, like you pointed out. And the longer you've done that, the easier it is to avoid, and the harder it is to actually face and work through what's going on there. Another thing too, is that since that a lot of times people are still in situations where the behavior that they're trying to forgive is still happening. And it's one thing to forgive something in the past, and it's the other to forgive yeah, something that's still happening to you. And sometimes part of the process isn't just forgiveness, but figuring out how to stop it, or how to get out of an unhealthy situation. So I think that complicates the process of forgiveness further.
Yeah, that's a great point, that it when you're trapped, and this is especially, you know, Sean works, Sean works with all ages, but Sean also works especially with children and teens. And that's an issue where they're often in situations that are traumatic, and they're just not of an age where they can move out of them. I'm going to reverse the order. I'm going to start with Sean and then go to Tom and then to Chris. I'm going to move to the last question that I wrote down for you guys, but again, take it wherever you want. You know, think about a client without divulging, well, you wouldn't divulge information, so don't worry about that. Think about a client you've had, or clients you've had, And what you've seen in their lives when they've been able to forgive at some level, what kind of changes you've seen in them when they have finally been able to forgive something, whatever it is.
Well, I think it's just that. I think that when that
forgiveness... But Sean, I'm going to ask you, can you think of a client? Can you think of a family or a client that you've actually worked with on that too? And kind of immerse it in that, if that's okay.
Yeah. Well, I said, I can think of, you know, a couple different type of situations like that at the least. And the deal is when you're holding on to that pain, that unforgiveness, you're stuck. But when you let go of that, then you have that peace and can address. And I can think of like working with a parent at one point who just really had a hard time admitting that they loved their kids. But just as they reached more peace in their situation, they could get to a place where they, okay, you know, I can admit to, you know, that I do, I struggle. And then when you have that struggle, when you at that place that you can admit that, you're freer to do something about it. And again, when you work through that pain from your past and you have that peace there, you can start to think about other things. And that's what I see with my clients, that when that pain starts to be let go, they have that freedom to heal.
Yeah, it's actually it's the parent almost kind of going, you know, I haven't felt loved, so therefore I can't admit that I love the others. But when they're able to kind of forgive something else in their life, it unlocks the love. And it does go to what Chris was saying earlier, which is those connections, but it also unlocks something spiritual, which is this sense of love, which I now can bestow on others. But as long as I was resentful, it was like I was packaging all the love and pushing it down, because if I don't feel lovable, how can I love others? And if I've been hurt and I can't, you know, someone who's supposed to love me did not show that. So yeah, that's great, Sean. Tom, what about you?
The one that jumps out to me is a gentleman who had invested probably, I don't know, 10 years of his life in a business with an understanding that it was going to lead to a certain result in the company. And he is the kind of person that it's all blood, sweat, and tears, 100% overtime, whatever it takes. And he had been assured, at least in his mind, that it was going to lead to a certain result. So fast forward, he comes to my office. He's devastated. He can't sleep. He's not eating. He's full of anxiety. He can barely drag himself to work and back because his expectations were, he was misled. And he could not get past this idea that everything that he had done for the past 10 years was, in his mind now, a waste, a failure. He had failed his family. He had been taken in, so to speak. So he first had gotten medication, met with his PCP, that wasn't working. And someone convinced him to come to counseling. So he had never been to a counselor before, had no experience with it. And we started with some things that would at least address some of the what we call cognitive distortions, right? We had to help him reframe some things, and that helped a little bit. And we worked on some other things. I won't even go through the battery of things that we went to, but here's the thing. When we got to the nub of his relationship with the boss, he just kept saying, I can't believe that he would do this to me. And to my family. And when I introduced the concept of him finding freedom by forgiving, it was like I was speaking Chinese. So it took us a couple of sessions to even work through the concept. And the thing that ended up being the turning point for him wasn't actually the act of forgiveness, because he was still struggling with that. But this scripture that I brought to him, in fact, I sent it to him after a session and said, based on your faith, and I think you would be open to this. And it was the one from Colossians 3, whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for men, since you know that you'll receive an inheritance from the Lord as a reward. It's the Lord Christ you are serving. That for him was the release point. He said, I could do that. I could stop feeling like I've been, that I'm under the thumb of an unjust master, and I can go there and do my work as if to the Lord. So it became the thing that opened the door, at least. Now, the whole completion of that forgiveness process, yeah, we'll leave that
Yeah, well, but you're bringing out something that we talked about, that hierarchy of needs. There's that self-transcendence. And what you did was you helped him work, in essence, higher, you know, mm-hmm. to move up and to begin to look at these things in different ways. And that there was a release that came when it ceased to be about the pain that's happened to me. Mm-hmm. And it became, okay, how do I open my life to serve? Mm-hmm. And so there's an implicit forgiving, at least the beginning of forgiveness that's mm-hmm. going on there. Mm-hmm. Chris, what about you? What are any experiences or thoughts about what you've seen when clients have been able to forgive?
Yeah, I think the impact is transformative, just as Sean and Tom just both described. I think it's really distorting a perception to be so angry and to hold on to so much anger, and it blots out anything good that's happening. I have a gentleman I'm working with now, and very, very angry at his wife, lots of examples of why. Coming in, and then we start talking about that he doesn't like himself in response to her. So then we start to looking at control of himself. He's behaving in ways he is not consistent with who he is, and that's a really painful thing. So we start working on that. Then he starts telling me, and I get really into detail with people because I love the details. He starts telling me the story of her, and he was being such a jerk. He blew up over the weekend, and she kept trying to connect with him in all these ways. And he was in such a shame state about his own behavior. And then I start to say, oh, it sounds like she kept trying though. And he said, she did. And I really couldn't understand it. I just couldn't even take it in. And I said, did you appreciate that? We start exploring that. And then I said, did you tell her that? He said, no, he tends to be very shut down. So we start planning for what would it be like to tell her that? It's so important. Long story short, he goes back, he's able to tell her, and she's very startled that he's starting to say to her, you know, I was such a jerk this weekend. I was, you know, really being difficult in these ways, because I'd worked with him on his shame stuff. So he could then go back and own something, which he never did. She would always have to blame him about something. So she was very shocked. And he starts to then say, I just want to thank you for sticking with me. I mean, that meant so much to me. We weren't making this up. This was truly his story. He just wasn't focused on that aspect of the story.
Yeah.
And then that was about 8 weeks ago. And he comes back every time. He's like, I can't believe how well things are still going. And so we started exploring the difference. And he had also been to his PCP. And she said, did your doctor give you a happy pill? You know, what is different? But he feels very different about himself.
Yeah. It sounds like part of the work is forgiving himself and forgiving whatever a source of trauma was in his past, that then allowed him to open up to a relationship in the present.
Yes. And to see that he's hanging on to a lot of things, not letting go of things. And there's no space for these really great nuggets of things that are happening. They're very positive that he is appreciative of, but he's never tending to those or speaking to them. And as soon as he starts to do that, that starts to grow. So it's this release and this letting go.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Sarah and Ted, it's past 10:45. I did want to create space for others to be able to ask questions if they had them. I don't know if we have the time to do that or what you would like us to do.
Well, so why don't we stop the recording here, and then we can continue the discussion.
Okay, sounds good.